Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, it's now or never, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. As a matter of fact, it was far more of a conversation and a little bit of sharing. So I have shared with Mr. Nally the contents of some of the petitions, the constitutional counties, and the unorganized militia. I've even kind of given him just a high-level view of the monetizing of the Reclaiming the Republic network and how to fund all of these local efforts. Because, you know, we got Soros doing it. Why can't we fund ourselves? And technically, that's what Reclaiming the Republic network will be doing, is funding ourselves. I mean, why not? You know, let everybody try to cling. I don't like preaching, but I can't impress upon you enough the importance of sacrifice and service. When we sacrifice for others, for the benefit of others, for a good purpose, a spiritual purpose, a righteous purpose, or just a noble purpose, I believe we get blessed. I believe that the Lord will continue to bless those of us who help others, who try to, you know, put aside our own interest and sacrifice our time and, you know, concentrate our efforts in trying to do something good. There's no doubt in my mind that we have the opportunity now to still stop this nation from falling off the edge. And so I see that as I deal with people, it seems like as they contribute, they do things. You know, there's these few that I know that are kind of torn because they've got a family that has needs, and they're let's say they're not independent financially enough to where they have to do things to actually put food on the table. And I believe that what happens is they get caught in this this spiral or this turning and churning. That when they start really doing things for others, that they actually get blessed with making money. And then as soon as they realize, well, money's coming in, then they focus on the money and they forget about their sacrifice. This kind of goes hand in hand with Malachi and how when Malachi basically said, you know, prove me now this day that you're willing to part of your substance, you know, to put things into the warehouse. You know, go read Malachi regarding robbing God, and that if we actually make sacrifices in assisting those who are in need, and when I say those who are in need, there are those who have, we'll call, you know, compassionate needs. They need food. They need medical attention. They need those types of things. They need to be comforted from what ails them, or, you know, basically what they're, you know, is harming them. Those things that are keeping them in, you know, in a bad state, not eating, not sleeping. You know, anyway, don't want to get into the every little facets of all this. What's important is that's important to self-sacrifice to helping those people. But how is making sacrifices in the name of liberty helping people? Folks, when a person is at a point where they can no longer choose for themselves and they become compelled to be saved by the state god or this national secular god that the state has created or the Antichrist himself, I truly believe that standing up and defending liberty actually is a call for, you know, a call of service for him and ensuring that people have the liberty and the agency to choose to follow him and worship him and continue doing these things. So when we start standing up and saying, you can't take away a right of conscience, you can't take away a right of religious expression. Now, there are people that are focused on just those. There's people that are focused on just some of the spiritual sides of this. But you know, what about education? As a matter of fact, one of the petitions that I need to include that I haven't, and I'm going to have to make a note right now, and as I look, I can handwrite a lot better than I can type. So one of the things I've done is I've, you know, I'm trying to keep a piece of paper and a pen, so you could probably hear this, but we need a petition regarding the education and the funding of education. And so when we get to that point, because we've talked about this, a petition regarding not paying, because we have a right to not allow an insurgency to be conducted in our school system, basically a perversion and a Bolshevik revolution in teaching children incorrect and outright lies about our government being a democracy, outright lies of what needs to be done, when actually it is 180 out. In other words, we have a responsibility to hold our education system to actually holding the line of teaching our children and preparing them to actually be productive members of a free society, not a subjugated member of a world enslavement of the globalist agenda. So, what we need to do is we need to actually start taking a stand. And the whole point of why I wrote that little note down, the whole point of all of this is, how do we choose? What are we going to do? What are you going to do to support liberty? Because I believe if you sacrifice, if you're willing to actually take your time, this is why, and this is to help you understand this whole monetizing. Monetizing isn't to pay for your time. Monetizing isn't to compensate you to, you know, help you build a better 401k or any type of incentives like that. Monetizing is to alleviate your needs, your burdens that you have to do to be successful in educating people and having meetings. So paying for the venue, paying for, you know, your domain space, paying for, you know, the resources that you need to become successful. And so this way, at least you don't have to take food off of your table. You don't have to take money out of your pocket to be able to do this. We're going to self-fund this. You know, Soros may actually buy and own people. I don't want to own you. I don't think any good person wants to own anyone. I think that anybody that is good in heart, you know, looks at indentured service or slavery or that type of paradigm of owning a person, a human being, is just repugnant. We've got a lot to go into, and I don't know when we'll have the next Paul Nally interview up and ready, but we're moving forward. And as soon as we, you know, are ready to broadcast, we'll get back into common law, because a common law is this huge thing that actually envelops everything. I want you to understand that as counties start standing up and doing these petitions and people start demanding that their constitution be complied with, and we start actually listing all of the things that are out of compliance, in essence, my friends, we're applying common law to republic review. Do you understand what I just said? Because common law is the voice of the people basically dictating and determining what the law is and what needs to be done to fix it. In other words, if you look at a common law grand jury and you look at your unorganized militia, you are in essence creating a citizen jury without asserting any legal authority to challenge those who are in power. Our job and responsibility is to petition them and challenging them via petition and then hitting them with the consequences because they have failed miserably and they deserve to be replaced. And then eventually, when we take enough control, we will make it so that they never, anybody, you know, and we need to start identifying those people who actually committed these atrocities, these sins, will actually be out for good. Now, we're going to actually talk about a couple principles coming up here. Ex post facto laws, bills of attainder and punishment, and so forth, and the spirit of those two laws that were injected into the Constitution. I'm going to give you a little history that I've been able to extrapolate for you so that, you know, it's better articulated than me just trying to, kind of create the wording. So we're going to be reading a little bit, so hang in there. But one of the things I also need to remind you, because too often we forget that this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you're listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. If you have not yet done so, have you subscribed to the Wyoming Constitute or Wyoming Conservative Chronicle? Ever since I created that Constitutional Chronicle, it kind of has just become forefront in my mind. This is what it's named, when actually it's not. If you're looking for getting financial stability and actually becoming independent financially, then reach out to Gary Smith at Fortitude Financial Coaching. I know there's lots of people out there that do this, but I know Gary Smith. I know the caliber of this man. I know how, you know, what a good and God-fearing man he is. Give him a call. He's here to help, and he's not from the government. And TimberNation.com. If you are looking for good quality furnishing, do not forget to go to TimberNation.com. And if you're looking for that, I can't tell you enough, get your own design if you're looking for something special. I mean, they will be willing and happy to give you what you need and what you want, something that's going to actually make you happy. I mean, come on. Isn't that the true, I guess, what a customer really wants is to be truly happy and having it the way they want it, right? I think there used to be a burger joint, have it your way. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to dive straight into these issues or the Bill of Rights stuff. We'll be right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're going to start off with these bills of attainder and punishment. Now, to kind of help you differentiate the difference between bills of attainder and bills of punishment and pain, or pain and punishment, whatever, bills of attainder basically is the application of death, where it basically they try you and say you're to be put to death. Or actually, you're not even tried. And we'll explain this and how laws can actually, and how legislatures can actually become judge, jury, and what we call, you know, the executioner, in so to speak. So the first part of this is actually extrapolated from Joseph Story's Commentaries on the Constitution, written in 1833 and published in 1838. And so Joseph's stories regarding bills of attainder are such special acts of the legislature as inflicting capital punishments upon persons supposed to be guilty of high offenses such as treason and felony without any conviction in the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. In other words, your right to trial by jury. In other words, they're creating a law and then calling for you to be killed. It's the same thing of them creating a law. And, well, let's get into this. If an act inflicts a milder degree of punishment than death, then it is called bills of pain and penalties, or pains and penalties. In such cases, the legislature assumes judicial magistracy and pronouncing upon the guilt of the party without any common forms and guards of trial, and satisfying itself with proofs when such proofs are within its reach, whether they are conformable to the rules of evidence or not. In short, in all cases, legislature exercising the highest power of sovereignty and what may be properly deemed an irresponsible despotic discretion, being governed solely by what it deems a political necessity or expediency, and too often under the influence of unreasonable fears or unfounded suspicions. So let me go a little bit further before we dive into this. The prohibition embodied in this clause is not to be narrowly construed in the context of traditional forms, but it is to be interpreted in accordance with the designs of the framers so as to preclude trial by legislature, which would violate the separation of powers. The clause thus prohibits all legislative acts, no matter what their form, quote, no matter what their form, that apply either to named individuals or easily ascertainable members of such a group in such a way as to inflict punishment upon them without a judicial trial. That the court has applied the clause dynamically is revealed by a consideration of three cases in which acts of Congress have been struck down as violating it. In the Ex Parte Garland, the court struck down a statute that required attorneys to take an oath that they had taken no part in the Confederate rebellion against the United States before they could practice in federal courts. The statute and state constitutional amendment requiring a similar oath of persons before they could practice certain professions were struck down as legislative acts inflicting punishment upon a specific group, the members of which had taken part in the rebellion and therefore could not truthfully take the oath. The clause then lay unused until 1946, when the court used it to strike down a rider to an appropriations bill forbidding the use of money appropriated in the bill to pay the salaries of three named persons whom the House of Representatives wished discharged because they were deemed to be subversive. Then in the United States versus Brown, a sharply divided court held void. Now, I want you to understand that they talk about the framers' intent behind this, and then they start easily deviating, and the courts are actually redefining what bills of attainder are. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So in this United States v. Brown, a sharply divided court held void as a bill of attainder a statute making it a crime for a member of the Communist Party to serve as an officer or as an employee of the labor union. Now, see, I think that these people actually forgot the Tory acts. I think that by this time, the Communist Party in the United States versus Brown, because what was this, in the 40s, 50s, or 60s? I mean, the Communist Party was obviously a 1900 issue. But let me continue going. Congress could, Chief Justice Warren wrote, for the majority under its, there's doubt on Warren, even Hugo Black, and many of these people that were actual communists, or their ties to all of this. Anyway, Warren wrote for the majority under its commerce power, protect the economy from harm by enacting a prohibition generally applicable to any person who commits certain acts or possesses certain correct characteristics, making him likely, in Congress's view, to initiate political strikes or other harmful deeds, and leaving it to the courts to determine whether a particular person committed the specific acts or possessed the specified characteristics. It was impermissible, however, for Congress to designate a class of persons, members of the Communist Party, as being forbidden to hold office or union office. However, in United States v. Robel in 1967, a very, very similar statute making it unlawful for any member of a communist action organization to be employed in a defense facility was struck down on the First Amendment grounds. So in other words, what I'm showing you is how the courts have actually perverted what this means. Now, I told you the Tory Acts. I've gone over this several times, that you have to be loyal to the Constitution to be a U.S. citizen. A communist is the antithesis of loyalty to the Constitution. A communist has no desire whatsoever in following the process. They're out to try to undermine, to violate, and overthrow our constitutional republic by using these types of unconstitutional laws. And so when we look at, you know, some of these decisions, well, first off, where in the heck in the Constitution does the federal government have any regulations over labor? They do have the requirement of dictating a member of the United States citizenry. In other words, for you to be a citizen, there's these parameters, and the parameters must be the same parameters that have been, I'll just say, integrated and integral to our society, that all people must support and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. This is fundamental. So when they talk about striking down this crime as a bill of attainder because they're punishing communists, no. Anybody that has violated the Constitution needs to be identified as just that, a enemy to the Constitution, and we have to deal with them appropriately. But when it comes to actual bills of attainder and punishment, or laws that are created to punish certain people, let's look at it in a perspective. Let's say the federal government can't create a law that will mandate and actually force you to take a shot or vaccination, even though they're doing it. They don't have the enumerated power in the first place. They shouldn't be involved in it or meddling it at all. But here's the beautiful thing. Article 1, Section 10 prohibits states from being able to pass bills of attainder or bills of attainder and punishment and pain. So if you understand that when the states start mandating that you have to take shots, in other words, they're basically punishing you, it doesn't matter if they're convicting you of a crime or actually saying you have to do this or you're ineligible to go to the school system or actually you can't even leave your home. You're ineligible to participate in society. That is a bill of attainder and or punishment because you chose not to get vaxxed. They can't do that. They have a right to protect your right of conscience. Now, the whole argument regarding vaccinations and an unvaxxed person going into a community where people are vaccinated, well, that should be okay, right? I mean, unvaccinated people getting together would be terrible because one person could be carrying it. But the vaccinated people, they should be indemnified. They shouldn't be harmed at all because they're vaccinated, unless the vaccination doesn't work. The whole point, my friends, is that they have no business meddling in these types of things and creating laws, whether it be Obamacare, whether it be enforcing you to actually engage or compelling you to become a part of something. Compelling you to actually take Obamacare and to have health care is a bill of attainder and punishment. The federal government, first off, has no constitutional standing in doing this. But secondly, when your state actually says we're going to, because the states have been using the federal government as their bully to say, well, the feds are making us do this. We don't want to do it, but we have to. No, they don't. And they're lying to you. And so What we need to start understanding is we need to understand the beauty of this Constitution and how it actually keeps them from passing these kinds of laws, because the intent of a bill of attainder and punishment or pain is to keep the legislatures from becoming the judge, jury, and executioner. In other words, it's one thing for them to create something that's a crime, but they can't actually, you know, create something that is legitimate, then all of a sudden create a crime. Because ergo, we're now talking about ex post facto laws. And so when we come back, we're going to get into ex post facto laws. But it just dawned on me, I didn't finish the petitions that we needed to cover for this intellectual property. There were three petitions we needed to cover. So we'll cover that, then we'll jump into the ex post facto laws. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's go into these petitions, shall we? And we kind of started covering the first one and setting up the second one, but we'll start over again, because all of these deal with the problem that we have with patents and copyrights. And again, clearly, as I think I'll read it to you again, because this is how it is read in the Constitution. The Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. Now, when we kind of look at, you know, how patents were done way back then, you know, and I'm going to tell you, I'm absolutely confident that when one looks at the first 10, 50, 100 years, really patents and copyrights were only extended out to people, individuals, and so forth. Corporations weren't really in play. There may have been some corporations that started going down that path, but they shouldn't have been, because as we've proven to you, it is all about the language in the Constitution, right? And that is for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries, not to the corporations, not to the religions, and so forth and so on. So again, first petition, there needs to be a differentiation between patents for persons and individuals, and the corporations cannot cannot possess any form of a patent or copyright. That it's one thing to grant that to the individuals, but it's another thing, those people involved in that. And so that what that means is that if you're a part of a corporation, you know, isn't it just typical that the corporation actually bullies you? They take your patents, they take your ideas, they patent it, and then they fire you. Well, how would the relationship change between the employer and the employee if all of a sudden the employees that actually generated the code or generated this design or this invention, this thing that they did, all of a sudden they're the ones that would be the holders of the patent? Well, shoot, it would kind of keep the corporation, you know, in behaving better and treating those people for what they did. Now, it's important to really try to create symbiotic relationships. But when we enable the big bad person that has the deep pockets to own and bully everything, it never bodes well. But when you actually empower the little guy, it actually forces that symbiotic relationship to occur because the corporations have to behave better. The only reason why corporations got away from having what we call, you know, pensions and benefits and those types of things that they used to actually provide that they don't anymore is because they don't have to. I mean, they're finally at a point where the only place where you can get a pension and, you know, retirement at an early age is in the public sector. That's it. It's sad. It's sad that the corporations have gotten themselves into a position where they don't have to treat their people good. I guess they're not making enough money. Well, that's hoppycock, right? We already know that if you actually go and look at the profits and everything else, these companies are making bank. So is it me that, you know, I see this hostility coming down from corporate headquarters? No. I think anybody that looks at this can say there is no doubt the corporations and these big pocket, you know, capitalists, if you want to call them capitalists, because they're really not capitalists. I mean, these are autocrats. These are despots. These are like monarchs. They have their own little kingdom, and they are waging oppression and, you know, tyranny upon their subjects, their employees. This is why we need to start actually protecting individual rights from corporations that are hostile towards the inalienable rights. This is why we're bringing these things to your attention. The next petition is regarding collectors. Individuals that do not create the patent, or do not create the art, they do not create the thing, the invention, the chemicals, what have you, like an Arab prince or some well-to-do crown or even the church. Patents and copyrights need to be tied to the individual, the actual individual who did the work, to ensure that their work is preserved and their credit for their work is recognized historically. And there needs to be a differentiation between a patent and or a copyright for art and entertainment instead of science, technology, manufacturing, and so forth, because this is where we have to start breaking down how we extend the copyrights to these different types of patents and copyrights, right? So the third one is we cannot allow long durations for patents that, you know, in those things that are not of the arts and entertainment. And what I mean by that is if it's a patent that is, you know, not being utilized, or it's a patent, you know, for, let's say, cancer treatments or high-efficiency engines that aren't being utilized, and they're basically suppressing this information and technology, this individual, well, nine times out of ten, the little guy is not going to do that. But what ends up happening, the reason why patents actually get suppressed is because the collector or the corporation buys them up. You see my point? You see how just this one little factor that all I need is money to maintain my dominance in the market space. Well, that's not a free market. And as a matter of fact, the way we've allowed patents to be migrated and merged by a purchaser, I'm sorry, it's one thing for the inventor himself to say, you know, I want to sell all my assets and resources, and I bequeath them too. and it was, or actually give them to. It's one thing to give, and it's another thing to bequeath, or I should say sell. And I've made the mistake. Bequeath is the same thing as give. But bottom line, what I'm trying to say is we have to start delineating and keeping corporations from being able to own it. So if somebody wants to give it away, that's fine. They have to give it to another person. It can't be given. A corporation cannot possess patents and copyrights, period. We really need to go down that path to say that has to belong to the individual, so that the corporation does not always have the upper hand in everything, because they've got the deeper pockets, they've got the banks, they've got all of these things. So this should require, then, when we look at transferrings and those types of things, this should actually even the durations should require a mediator type of intervention. So let's just say you've got a patent, and the patent is 5 years for technology. And I think it should be even less because of Moore's Law. I mean, that chip and what they have done when they finally bring forward. So you got to understand, when do they put the patent on that chip? The patent should be very quick and easy, and it should be very short duration. And so when Intel comes out with their new chip, when they come out with their new chip, that patent should actually be in place. And there are ways to create their own protections. You know, when you write something, an author, basically they just mail the idea to themselves so that they have physical and legal evidence that this is their idea. So that inventor has this protection. Corporations can provide that protection for their individual inventors. But when they start creating these long duration patents to keep people from, and here's the thing, when Intel comes out with the next platform, that patent, the old patent on the old stuff, why is it that they're keeping those things? Oh, well, because they don't want somebody else to sell those. I'm sorry. I mean, you're already coming out with the new innovation and the next one and the next one and the next one. We need to actually make sure that these things actually expire quickly. When they come out with the next generation, they can't hold on to the new one. They shouldn't be able to hold on to the new one. I submit that it is better for society for them to just keep moving forward than it is for them to hold everything back so that they can control your access to the older, inferior technology and products. Why are they doing that? Ah, you know why. It's about the money. So the magistrates, or I should say actually, and let's change the term, let's look at this in common law. And so it would be basically like a grand jury or the people themselves that would have to actually, investigate and fully look at all of the details to come up with what should be done. What should be the outcome when we're talking about a patent and or a holder, and the just compensation for, whether they should maintain that or whether they should lose their patent because it's overcome by events or they are causing a problem. Let's just say that there is a terrible epidemic that occurs, that actually starts killing lots of people, and somebody already has a patent for it, and they refuse to allow that patent and the production of that product to be made because they have this product long term. It's kind of like, was it quercetin or ivermectin? I think it was quercetin. Whatever those pills were regarding COVID, that first came out to say, hey, these are a huge assistance for patients or people that have gotten COVID and gets them out of danger very quickly and gets them healthy very quickly. Well, all of a sudden the government said, no, we're gonna kind of lock that down. We're going to make it impossible for you to get that. We're going to kind of, constrain that in the market space. Well, that's the same thing as actually killing people and harming. I can't believe that the government has gone into that type of space or into that, that paradigm. So We need common law. And even though we have representatives, we absolutely have to have independent people. This is why we have grand juries where they can actually make these determinations and decisions. We'll be right back.
Taking the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic. I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now that we've kind of covered these petitions, because I think we've covered it sufficiently, then let's go ahead and move forward and start going more deeper into these things called ex post facto laws, because we just kind of finished with bills of attainder. Now, in both of these, the states and the federal government are prohibited from using. An ex post facto law is simply a law, or it refers to a criminal type of statute that punishes actions retroactively, thereby criminalizing conduct that was legal when originally performed. So we get into this gray area where we kind of can create these bills of attainder and ex post facto laws when it comes down to things like your water rights. When states start passing laws that say, even though you have property and you don't have a well on it, we're going to make it illegal for you to put a well on your property. Criminal. We'll come in and take it. We'll fine you. We will punish you. They may not kill you, but they basically have taken away your water rights. Now, as near as I can tell, nobody, when you own that land, nobody can tell you you don't have mineral rights to that land. Now, the state can basically say that, you know, they have a stewardship somewhat over that as well. But the federal government, when they started stealing water, land, or water, minerals, and all these other rights to your land, to where you basically only own the structure that sits on it, that becomes problematic because there's nothing in the Constitution that's delegated that to them. But I digress. This is about ex post facto laws. So both federal and state governments, again, are prohibited from enacting ex post facto laws. And the courts apply the same analysis whether the law in question is a federal or state enactment. When these prohibitions were adopted as a part of the original Constitution, many persons understood the term ex post facto laws to embrace all retroactive laws or laws governing or controlling past transactions, whether of a civil or criminal nature. So I need to highlight that one bit of language. because as we move forward, you will notice that they started ignoring the civil nature and they only started looking at crime. Now, I want you to understand that the federal government only has the ability to prosecute and create two crimes, or the punishments, defining and determining the punishment of two crimes. They only have jurisdiction over two crimes under that Constitution that actually occur within the United States, which is counterfeiting and treason. All other crimes are left to the states. So the fact that they're even creating crimes is a violation of ex post facto laws. They have no authority over doing that. And to create that crime, is it doesn't matter whether they're doing it moving forward or anything. It's unconstitutional. They have to have the power delegated to them first, and they don't. So anyway, now let's move forward, because this is how the federal government looks at it. But in the early case of Calder v. Bull, the Supreme Court decided that the phrase as used in the Constitution was a term of art that applied only to penal and criminal statutes, although it is inapplicable in retroactive legislation of any other kind. The constitutional prohibition may not be evaded by giving a civil form to measure that is essentially criminal. Every law that makes an act criminal that was actually innocent when done and inflicts a greater punishment than the law annexed to the crime when committed is an ex post facto law when the prohibition of the and a prohibition within the Constitution. The issue of whether a law is civil or punitive in nature is essentially the same for an ex post facto law and for double jeopardy analysis. A court must ascertain whether the legislature intended the statute to establish civil proceedings. A court will, today, in today's era, a court will reject the legislature's manifest intent only where a party challenging the acts provides the clearest proof that the statutory scheme is so punitive in either purpose or effect to negate the state's intention. A statute that has been basically held to be civil and not criminal in nature cannot be deemed punitive as applied to a single individual. Are you kidding me? See, this is how they've wandered. Because it is reprehensible that one innocent man go to jail, but it's now okay that they can punish, you know, somebody, an innocent person, or somebody that did something that when they did it was innocent, and then they pass a law and now they can inflict some pain upon you. My friends, we have to start definitizing. So why am I covering both of these? And the next thing that I'm going to actually cover, the next thing that is up in the queue to be covered, is citizenship. And the reason, because all three of these things we're covering today are things that have to be definitized, that the states clearly need to step up and say, you know, they have completely perverted this concept. They've completely perverted this concept of ex post facto laws, bills of attainder and punishment, and even citizenship, as they've gone and moved forward in trying to redefine and redefine. So I'm going to give you a little history, extrapolated and kind of condensed here, over the history of naturalization requirements in the United States. Now, before the Act of March 26, 1790, naturalization was under the control of the individual states. This first federal activity established a uniform rule for naturalization by setting the residence requirement at 2 years. The Act of January 29, 1790 repealed the 1790 Act and raised the residency requirement to 5 years. It also required, for the first time, a declaration of intention to seek citizenship for at least 3 years before naturalization. Along came the Naturalization Act of 1798. Now, so far, anybody and everybody that wanted to be naturalized was able to be naturalized. Along came the Naturalization Act of 1798. Now, what was going on in 1798 in Congress? Isn't that when they passed the Alien and Sedition Acts? Yep. This is where Congress actually started turning dark, turning evil. A time when political tensions were running high and there was an increased desire to guard the nation. The residence requirement for naturalization was raised from 5 to 14 years. 4 years later, Congress passed the Naturalization Act of April 14, 1802, which reduced the residency period for naturalization from 14 back to 5. The Act of May 26, 1824 made it easier for the naturalization of certain aliens who had entered the U.S. as minors by setting a 2-year instead of 3-year interval between the Declaration of Intention and the admission to citizenship. In 1922, it was basically an extension of the 1921 Act and included an amendment that changed the residency requirement in a Western Hemisphere country from 1 year to the current requirement of 5 years. So in other words, they've been playing with these different residency requirements. If you actually go and you look, a U.S. citizen was eventually moved into a racial and a, if you want to call it, a gender by the United States government. Basically, it was framed and denned that a U.S. citizen really needed to be a white male property owner. And so when they started doing that, they actually violated the citizenship of people that were already citizens. Citizens of the states at that point in time became citizens of the Union. When the Constitution could not say, oh, if you have citizens, we're not going to recognize them. This is why when the United States government started doing this and states actually protected the rights of blacks and other individuals that were citizens and actually voting, but they didn't meet the parameters, this is why we find that, they started going more and more down this path of segregation, racism, and those types of things. This is only more evidence to show that they started trying to become more and more divisive in dividing America. But anyway, back to this history. Non-citizens who served honorably, let me see, so this is 1968. Non-citizens who served honorably in the U.S. Armed Forces during the Vietnam War or in other periods of military hostilities were recognized in the Act of October 24, 1968. This act amended the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, providing an expedited naturalization process for these military members. The 2-year continuous U.S. residence requirement was done away with in the Act of October 5, 1978. A major overhaul of immigration law occurred with the Immigration Act of November 29, 1990. In it, state residency requirements were reduced to the current requirement of 3 months. That was under Bush's reign, Bush Sr. If you start seeing how the globalists started watering down and trying to make it so that anybody could become a resident and actually become a U.S. citizen, I cannot emphasize enough what we were talking about at the very beginning regarding Tory Acts, regarding the fact that people must, if you're going to be a U.S. citizen, you are required legally to support the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign and domestic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.